Let me first describe the title. It had something about electronic structure, correlated electrons, and dynamical mean field theory. And let me start with an outline of what I would like to cover in this talk. So first, I would like you to give you an idea of what are strongly correlated electrons. Why are they interesting? Why they are difficult to treat? So I will do that by presenting a comparison where with where solid state theory stands vis-a-vis weakly correlated electrons. Because I think that even the concept of what is a strongly correlated electron system is not something which is very sharply defined. So in order to introduce the ideas, I think it's good to present where strongly versus weakly correlated systems. So we'll start very basic, just reviewing what we all know, which is the standard model of solid state physics, which intends to describe systems such as silicon, aluminum, etc. Then I'll try to move on and explain why that doesn't work for a class of materials which we call strongly correlated electrons. Then I will introduce a technique, which is the dynamical mean field theory, which has given, I'll try to convince you that has given some new insights into this very old problem. And then, going along with the title of the workshop, I will try to show some applications to materials. But before I do that, I would like to discuss how DMFT was applied to a toy model of the Mach transition, because I think that toy model contains a lot of the basic physics and the techniques that are needed to move here. And then I will conclude with some outlook and challenges and explain a little bit what we're trying to do here. Okay, so to get started, we all understand systems such as aluminum, silicon, simple metals. Why? Well, because we have a standard model for it, and because we have techniques which are powerful enough to calculate for them with great accuracy. So the standard model starts simply with a wave picture of the electron. We sort of imagine that the electron is in a solid and it forms a wave, is completely localized. It sees a periodic potential, and therefore it has to build some waves which disperse. So we have an energy versus K, and we have bands in the solid, and the dispersion is not K squared over 2m, it's renormalized by the potential, but this is a simple picture which allows us to understand why there are metals when the chemical potential is here, and when we have insulators when the chemical potential is in a gap. And a lot of what has been done in strongly correlated electrons has been to substantiate that picture by incorporating the effects of electron-electron correlations. One can show that, and that goes under the name of Landau-Fermi liquid theory and can also be put in a rigorous renormalization group setting, that what the electron-electron interactions do at low energies is simply renormalize the parameters of those electrons. So still at low energies, we have a picture of free electrons, and all that the interactions do is enter via some parameters in the low energy theory, for example, the mass of the electron, or the magnetic moment of the electron, or parameters which enter in the response to external fields, which are so-called Fermi liquid parameters. And this as much as the qualitative stuff, then one, on the basis of this, one can calculate, for example, leading temperature dependence of transport coefficients. For example, the resistivity is proportional to T squared. The thermoelectric power has to be linear in temperature. And the Hall coefficient, for example, does not depend on temperature at sufficiently low temperatures. One can also get a simple picture of the optics. The optical conductivity of a material is simply transitions between the different bands. And also, the very nature of this theory as being a theory of waves makes more qualitative predictions. For example, the resistivity or the conductivity of a system cannot exceed the so-called Joffe-Regel conductivity, sigma max, which is E square over H KF times KFL, where L is a mean free path and KF is a Fermi wave vector. And the reason for it is that if we're talking about waves and we have a picture that the waves are sort of scattered, the mean free path always has to be at least longer than the wavelength of the particles. So KFL has to always be bigger than one. So the conductivity of a metal cannot exceed this limit, which is called the Joffe-Regel limit, which is around 100, 200 microohms centimeters inverse for the resistivity. Okay, so this would be rho max, rho min. Of course, we can have insulators such as silicon where the conductivity is zero and the resistivity is infinite. But the metal, where the waves can propagate, cannot be too resistive. And finally, to complete this beautiful building, this beautiful edifice of solid state theory, we have computational tools for really extract the physical properties of the solid. And that goes under the name of density functional theory, or DFT. And this has been an extraordinarily successful theory in the sense that it allows to not just say that things should behave in a certain way, but actually put real numbers behind the bands, the phonon spectra, even the magnetic moments of a large variety of materials. And the idea here is extremely simple and is basically ideas underlying Legendre transformation. One can actually view the free energy of a solid as a function of the crystal potential. And instead of looking at a function of the external crystal potential, we can do a Legendre transformation and switch variables to the density. So we can go from here via Legendre transformation to something which is called a density functional. And in principle, this is an exact construction. It always, as long as one can invert the density in terms of the crystal potential, one can always Legendre transform. And the total energy of the system, by the way, if there's any questions, please interrupt me at any time. It makes it easier to give a Blackboard talk. So the energy of the solid and the density of the solid are computed by minimizing this functional of the density. Now, in principle, it's as hard to evaluate this functional as to solve the quantum many-body problem. But the virtue of this approach is that simple approximations for this functional have been constructed. And that's what's called for example, the local density approximation, and that's what has given rise to a large number of very accurate predictions in solid-state systems. Just to give you some idea, the phonon spectrum of silicon, which is a fairly complicated system, can be predicted very cheaply with 1% accuracy. So the moments of iron and nickel, and again, the only information that goes in there is just the position of the atoms and the charge of the atoms. So they're completely first principle predictions. And again, the moments of nickel and iron can be predicted also with 1 or 2% accuracy. Okay, now, another useful concept in density functional theory is the idea of a Kohn-Sham system, a Kohn-Sham reference system. And that's the idea that these equations, which give you the minimum to get the density of the system, can be cast in a form which look like single particle-like equations. So we have something like a Schrödinger-like equation, which has to be solved self-consistently. So that gives us the density. And the Kohn-Sham potential is just the external potential plus the Hartree potential plus some unknown exchange correlation potential for which we have to find simple approximations. So in practice, this is what's done in order to compute with great deal accuracy the properties of weakly correlated solids. And it's a relatively simple system of equations. And
why isn't this called mean filter?
This is called, well, again, why it isn't called mean field theory, why it is called mean field theory. Well, I mean, again, in principle, this is the nice thing about effective actions. If you have the exact effective action of the problem, if you had this exact exchange and correlation potential, then this approach would be exact. Now, in reality, we need to do some approximations to the effective action of the problem. The approximation which is used very often is just to pretend that the system is uniform. So it's essentially what it would be like a local approximation in your effective action. This is what's called LDA. And that means that we have to take here the exchange and correlation potential of a uniform electron gas, which we can obtain, for example, by solving the electron gas once and for all numerically and parameterizing what is V of rho. Then this is no longer a functional of the density, but it's just a function of rho of r. Okay? Now, if instead of, but your observation is quite correct, that this really has the form of a mean field theory and of a static mean field theory, and what this thing does, it really makes like a one-to-one correspondence of the interacting system with a system of non-interacting fictitious particles. And well, this set of particles, the only goal of this is to compute the density and the total energy. It turns out that in practice, the energies that we get from here are not very far from the excitation spectra that one measures experimentally. Furthermore, one can say this is just my first step in the many-body theory, and I will add to, but I will take that as an excellent starting point, and I will do what it's called a GW approximation, which means to say that my self-energy of the solid is just the lowest order graph in the screen-Coulomb interactions minus the exchange and correlation potential. So if you take this as your self-energy, then turns out that this is quite accurate to predict many physical properties of metals and semiconductors. So this is the end of the description of the state of the art, if you want, of where strongly weakly correlated systems are. With this scheme and improvements, one can basically compute almost with really enormous accuracy pretty much all the physical properties of weakly correlated solids. So foundation.
But this should be qualified a little in the sense that one really can calculate so well only ground state properties.
Well,
at higher temperature, I mean, depending on what you look at, it's.
I would say I agree completely. This is perhaps it was somewhat exaggerated statement. What I should say is that the state of the art, I would say, is that we definitely understand conceptually what is the character of the ground state and the low energy excitations. And furthermore, unlike strongly correlated electron systems, we can get some numbers for these things. And in a large number of examples that have been studied, those numbers are in quite good agreement with experiments, so this can be thought of having some predictive power. I would say that in my mind, of course, this is also a very, it depends how, it brings us to a question of what do we really want to know, right? I mean, how accurate do we want to be? And this is, of course, even for weakly correlated systems, this is still a very intensive area of research. But I just presented this to contrast it with a situation when now we leave the part of the periodic table where we feel very safe, where we have carbon and SP systems, and we start moving down the periodic table, and we encounter systems that have open shells that have D and F electrons, and then the situation is not so good. And in fact, this nice edifice no longer works. And that's something that was noted early on by Mott, who observed that in a case that of nickel oxide or manganese oxide, the predictions of this approach were even qualitatively wrong. That is, you take something which has an odd number of electrons per site, which according to the band theory ought to be here and should be metallic, and they're actually insulating with gaps which are 2 or 3 or 4 or even up to 6 eV. So the qualitatively there's something wrong, and the way that he went on to rationalize what we should do is to go to a real space picture, forget about the wave picture, and now think of the electron as a particle, and then simply think that each particle is localized around a single his own atom. And the famous example he introduced is a collection of hydrogen atoms, and he argued that if those atoms are much further from each other than their Bohr radii, if this distance A is much bigger than A Bohr, then in that case, the system should be insulating, even though there's one electron per site. And here, that's sort of a picture of the ground state. Eventually, there are some residual interactions, which is called super exchange, between the spins or the orbits or whatever residual degrees of freedom we have in the atom. And as a result of that, this system eventually orders at very low temperatures. But at finite temperatures, we have a system which is highly degenerate. which is the reason why it's not so easy to treat if we start from a wave picture. And the excitations in this system, yes?
Can I make a comment on the mock?
Sure.
Of course, as you say, the band picture gives a wrong, thoroughly wrong prediction about the very conducting behavior. And if you look at the solutions of the quantum equation, in particular, not only at the total ground state, but at the low-lying excited states, you also get qualitatively wrong predictions. On the other hand, for the ground state, even of a mock insulator, we do have a very important mathematical theorem by Chase and Chase that the density, ground state density, and ground state energy can still be represented by this theorem. Now, of course, the interesting aspect of a mock insulator is not the ground state density of energy, but the insulator theory. And that does not come out of that simple theory. But I just wanted to explain, you said that the edifice breaks down. The edifice does not break down. The edifice, in fact, was proved by Chase and Chase. It becomes a little more complicated. You have to do the general density functional theory. You may have to do the general density functional theory, but we know how to do that. So for the ground state, energy and density, that is preserved.
Yes, I agree with you completely, but what I said, the edifice breaks down, what I meant really is that now probably the exchange, and I think you would agree with me, that in this case the exact exchange and correlation potential which I get will not be a good starting point to do simple perturbation theory in the electron-electron interactions. And that's the reason why, and the reason for that is that the spectrum is completely different, and it's very hard to think how I would start with the spectrum of the Kohn-Sham system and arrive at the spectrum of something like nickel oxide or like the high-temperature superconductor. So, of course, for the ground state energy and for the total energy and density, in principle, if I have the exact exchange and correlation potential, I should be able to get it. And in that sense, the density functional theory is an exact theory. So what I meant that this breaks down, I meant this as a starting point towards building a theory of transport and thermodynamics and excitation spectrum of correlated materials. But I agree with your statement. Okay, so then what do? We have this highly degenerate system, and what are the excitation spectrums here? Well, the excitation, we can think of them as, for example, if I add an extra electron or if I remove an electron here, the excitation spectra are things which are called Haber bands. And the Haber bands are just atomic excitations which are moving throughout the system. And because the system is fluctuating and it's degenerate, those bands are not simple bands in K-space. They're just excitations that move around and cannot be really continued smoothly into the Kohn-Sham bands. And then the problem that we have already is how to bridge between these two pictures. That is, we have a band theory that works well when the effective electron-electron interactions over some hopping is small. We have atomic-like physics, which works when Q over T is much bigger than 1. And the question is how to handle things in the middle where the electron is neither fully itinerant or fully localized, and this is a known problem when the atoms have closed shells, because then one can easily go from one limit to the other continuously. But if we are above the null temperature of the material, and if we have an open shell, it's not the perturbation theory around this limit and around that limit don't merge smoothly in the middle. And I think this is the heart of the strong correlation problem and why it's such a difficult non-perturbative problem from a theoretical point of view. And from a material science point of view, there are many, many, many materials which fall in there. And they all do extraordinarily interesting things. And intermetallic compounds containing F and D elements keep being discovered. For the purpose of an introduction, I would just mention briefly some of the problems. One interesting problem was the problem of the mod transition in V2O3. This is a material where if we, in its phase diagram, as a function of pressure and temperature, and pressure here, you can think of it as somehow like chemical pressure. So let me just plot inverse pressure. So when the pressure is high, we have a metallic phase. If we increase the distance between the atoms, we have a paramagnetic insulating phase. And then there is actually a line of first order phase transitions ending in a second order point separating the two. And then at lower temperatures, we have various forms of antiferromagnetic and perhaps orbital order. Okay, so here the interesting phenomena is a large change of the resistivity, and we have a dramatic change of the physical properties of the system simply because we have to go between a band-like state and an insulating state. Now, this is the first example. Then there were things which are called heavy fermions. Those are materials which contain rare earths and also some SPD band. And what was extraordinary about these materials is that at low temperatures, at least in some intermediate range, the Fermi liquid theory was valid, but the masses were enormous. Things up to of the order of 1,000 electron mass were found. Then, of course, there are the high temperature superconductors that you know everything about. Here, the phenomena which was most striking is an unusually high critical temperature. There are things like the manganites, lanthanum, strontium, manganese O3, which have what it's called colossal magnetoresistance. Here the response to a field is anomalously large. And the list really goes on and on and on. One can spend many hours describing the various interesting things that strongly correlated materials do. Just to give some known, perhaps things which are not so well known, one can find very large, ultra-fast optical nonlinearities in a 1D, in a quasi-1D cuprate strontium copper O3. And one has gigantic thermoelectric powers in scaterodites such as cerium, iron, phosphorus 12. And there are really an enormous list of problems in once we sort of leave the top of the periodic table and we start having D and F elements in our compound. And
can I make another comment here?
Yes.
The situation concerning D electrons was really changed when introduced the super soft pseudopotential.
Vanderbilt.
Vanderbilt, thank you. Right, so that people now get very good quantitative results for D electrons. That change took place about 5 or 10 years ago.
I don't agree.
Okay. In the relevant temperature range, so from my perspective, what's interesting about all these materials is that in the relevant temperature range where you measure, the standard model does not apply. So not only those systems are interesting from a technological point of view, but also from the point of view of describing all their physical properties, the thing I listed here, the resistivity goes as T squared, the thermoelectric power is linear, the Hall effect is constant, the optics is very simple transition between the states. None of this applies. Okay? And I'll give you some examples. And then I will move on to what we would like to do about it. So I should stress that, in my view, there's no such a thing as a general theory of strongly correlated materials. There's not just one first principle that will explain everything, but there are some common things that I will try to highlight before we go to more system-specific things, and to just give you an idea of the puzzles and the challenges that we face. So,
can I just ask a simple question for a minute?
Yes.
The comment that many of these materials are in this limit where the electron interaction is comparable to the kinetic energy.
Right.
Is that really just coming from the fact that as long as you're at zero pressure, those are the things that set the mean density? Those two pieces of physics are what set the mean density, or is it coming through it?
Well, there are materials which are not in that regime, like aluminum.
No, I understand, but I'm just saying, if I force you on the back of an envelope to tell me why the mean density is 8 grams per cubic centimeter, isn't it just balancing electron Fermi energy side of the mean ion potential, or something like that?
Well, so but yeah, that's true. But then this is sort of a rough estimate. What we're faced with is that we have the space of all possible materials.
Understood.
And there are some which are in a regime where the band theory does work. And what's going on physically is that when we go down in the periodic table, the potential that those D and F electrons feel is getting deeper and deeper. And that causes some changes in the wave function, which increases, in some sense, the localization and makes the kinetic energy weaker, if you want. That's how we get into the strongly correlated end. Okay, so just examples of breakdown of, say, GW or perturbative approaches is this phase diagram. I mean, I believe that by expanding around a metallic state, one will not get this phase diagram, and so far, no approach based on versions of the density functional theory has been able to get this kind of metal insulator transition. The other example is of the breakdown of this model is that strongly correlated materials are very resistive. They routinely have resistivities which exceeds the Mott-Joffe-Regel limit. And just to give you some examples, the buckyballs have essentially a quadratic temperature dependence of the resistivity, but the Joffe-Regel limit would be around 200 micro-ohm centimeters, and resistivities as high as 6,000 micro-ohm centimeters have been measured before the system melts around, say, 500 degrees. The same thing is true, so this would be buckyballs, the rubidium 3 C60. And again, it brings the point that strong correlations not only exist with D electrons, but also you can have P electrons involved. And the resistivity of the cuprates is a very famous, it's very linear until it becomes superconducting. And again, in the under-doped regions, one can exceed several times the Ioffe-Regel limit. And then the lithium, I just picked some examples to illustrate this point. The point I want to make is that the resistivity is not always having some specific functional form. Sometimes it's linear, sometimes it's quadratic. The thing which is common to all these diverse materials is that they can be metallic, but still exceed by several factors the Ioffe-Regel limit. So that's the thing which is common. And of course, the V2O3 near this metal insular transition also has this highly unusual property. So this can be, if you want, a second puzzle, why they are so resistive. And a third puzzle is what I called...
Excuse me. I have not seen the Ioffe-Regel limit used for high temperatures. Is it intended for that?
Well, I would say that, of course, there has to be something wrong with the argument that the resistivity cannot be bigger than a certain number if experimentally it is. So it's true. The point is that the point I'm trying to make is that we need some understanding of what are the carriers in the system when we have resistivities which are so large. A simple picture which is based on waves which are propagating and scattered with some mean free path, which comes from phonons of some other excitation to which the electrons are perturbatively coupled, is not going to explain this, because in that picture, the KFL has to be bigger than one. So I'm presenting this as a puzzle, as something that one needs to have some approach which can cope with this. And approaches where you stand with well-defined waves which are perturbed around it will not do. So the Ioffe-Regel criteria was used to treat electrons at zero temperature in the presence of disorder, but this is sort of a general point about strongly correlated electrons, which has made by many people, say starting from Anderson, Emery, and Kivelson, et cetera, that these systems are very resistive. So a theory of these materials should produce that. And it's not so simple.
I think one needs to obviously rethink the Ioffe-Regel limit when you apply it to high temperature.
Yeah.
So the conflict with that limit at high temperature needs to be thought about.
I agree. All I want to say is that if your high temperature picture just involves simple quasiparticles which are scattered through some potential, some phonon, some imperfection, in a Boltzmann, simple Boltzmann-like theory, you'll be led to an expression of this form. And, well, if you want to fit numbers with that, it won't work. So you have to have a theory of what the carriers are. Yes?
What do normal things like, if you mentioned aluminum, do as a function of temperature?
They're linear, but the scale is totally different. It will be here.
So it doesn't exceed the...
Of course, not anywhere near. And I might even have here, just to give you some idea. I mean, this is even something which people were puzzled. This is niobium. It's totally off scale.
Does Gabby, in the case of the fullerene, in this case, you have these phonons, you have this molecular level, so the bands are very narrow, and all the phonons, what they do, they don't modify the Hopping intervals, but they make the levels go up and down, so these narrow bands.
Again,
so it's just on-site phonons. Maybe that explains it.
Again, I mean, one needs some many-body treatment in that regime. Simple perturbation theory around plane waves won't do it. One more thing which somehow stressed the idea that we have to build some understanding of what the states are is the phenomena which I would call anomalous transfer of spectral weight. And that was observed first in the optics of materials such as iron silicide, but was later observed near the metal insulator transition in vanadium oxide. And is the idea that we know that we have an optical sum rule. So if the integral, so we're measuring conductivity. So we know that we have an optical sum rule. The integral of sigma of omega d omega has to be something proportional to the number of carriers divided by the mass of the electron. So in principle, if we integrate up to infinity, the total spectral weight has to be conserved. However, in many materials, this conservation of spectral weight is highly non-local. So what these systems do is the following. Iron silicide at high temperatures is a metal. And then when you start lowering the temperature, it begins to open a gap. But the point is that as it opens the gap, you lose spectral weight at low energies, and it's not fully recovered near the gap, but it's transferred at much higher frequencies. Of course, the sum rule has to be satisfied, but the point is that the effective sum rules, here we have some current. This is basically the current-current correlation function. When we derive some low-energy theory, which has some low-energy Hamiltonian and some low-energy current, then the operator which represents the current at low energies, that doesn't have a spectral weight which is conserved at low frequencies. And what this indicates, again, that the simple picture of just having some rigid bands where we have some states and what the optics does is simple transition between the states is not valid, that the states are changing as we change our energy scale. And the first thing that we need before we have a theory of these kind of materials is some way of computing those what those states are. Okay? So that's basically the first part of the talk. And what yes.
Again, I'm not sure that this has to do with the states indirectly, yes, but these effects also happen in semiconductors as so-called local field effects. If you have interband transitions due to, let's say, gap opening, then simply because the optical response is very non-local, maybe that's what you meant by non-local, in the sense that the electron hole excitations interact both on a local and on a very large, long space distance behavior, the dielectric function is a complicated object. It's a matrix. Once you invert this matrix, you have basically the sum in real space over electron hole spheres on the short distance.
I thought he was talking below interband transition, but about,
No. The point I want to make is if you have an interband transition or a band opening of very small energy, simply because of these non-local effects, you can have effects of the order of Fuller energy shifts to high energy. And this happens in semiconductors, is well known, and has not so much to do with the internal structure of the underlying quasar particles. But it has to do with the, again, localization of the physics on an atomic scale. So the periodicity of d orbitals, for example, enters very substantially.
I think in a semiconductor, I think that if we sit down, probably we can understand what is the effective Hamiltonian, what are the energy scales, and we can probably satisfy the F sum rule in the right energy range. What is interesting here is that we don't know what is the correct effective Hamiltonian to use, and it's surprising this phenomena takes place at low energies, and you still transfer, this gap can be of the order of 100 degrees, and then you transfer spectral weight up to 2 EVs, or to very, very, very far away. And I'm convinced that the low-energy model describing this does not satisfy or has a temperature dependent here in the right hand side of the F-SUM rule. So in that sense, I think that this, that semiconductors we do understand, and strongly correlated electrons need a little bit more work.
So it's probably worth pointing out that this transfer spectral rates arises in metals, in transfer related metals, not only
right.
in such a material, which is a nuclear.
Right. Okay, that's a good point too. Okay, so now basically, what do we do when we're confronted with some non-perturbative phenomena? I hope that I convince you that this stuff is non-perturbative, or at least cannot be described by simple pictures based on expanding around plane waves or waves in weak electron-electron interactions. So in order to get some handle on this, one needs some tool, and what I would like to describe is what is called dynamical mean field theory. And the, by the way, how much time I have in this? Because I'm afraid that.
You certainly have time to present dynamical mean field theory.
All right. Okay, no, because I want to get to some results. So, all right. So let me just explain the basic idea by analogy with some, what is a mean field theory? Mean field theory is something which takes a lattice model and reduces to a single side problem. So if we have, for example, the Ising Hamiltonian, we want to reduce it to some effective field times a spin. So we select a specific site and we just simply take out the environment and we represent all the other spins by the Weiss field. Now, we want to do the same thing for quantum problems. So we have something like the Hubbard Hamiltonian. And we want to do this reduction. We want to reduce that to a single side problem. So how do we do that? Well, the strategy is very similar. That is, we focus now on a single site, and we want to derive the effective action for that local site. So we keep basically all the local terms that we would have. So those are the terms that were in the original Hamiltonian, the Hubbard-like in this example. And now the effect of all the neighbors and the rest of the lattice enters via a Weiss field, which in this case has to be retarded. Plus, there will be higher order 4-point, 6-point, etc. corrections that at this stage I will neglect. And then, just like here, what we need is some self-consistent equation for this effective field here, which is the thing that gives us that the magnetization is tanh beta times j m times the number of neighbors. We need here a self-consistency condition that will determine us, for us, the Weiss field. So what is this? This is something which relates a local quantity which can be computed with the local action to the local quantity itself. So the analogies are that the Green's function of the problem is equivalent to the magnetization. This hybridization function is the analogous thing to the Weiss field. And the self-consistency equation, which corresponds to that, is something that one can write down, and is that the Green's function of the problem, which is, of course, a functional of the Weiss field, has to obey a self-consistency condition of the form delta by omega n. I will describe in a second the physical meaning of that. And it says that you can think of this as the equivalent equation where we say that the magnetization is the tangents beta jij mj. So this, if you want, involves the lattice via the gijs. This involves the lattice via these hoppings, which are the Fourier transform of the T of K. And the physical content of this is that in a mean field sense, the self-energy of the problem, which normally is something which depends on wave vector and frequency, in this case is taken just to be a function of frequency. And this is the Green's function, the local Green's function computed assuming a local self-energy. And this is the local Green's function computed from the local effective action. In any case, this is very similar to the effective medium theory of CPA for the disorder solid. The new concept or the new idea now is that the Green's function of the problem now is the solution of an Anderson impurity or a quantum problem, which is written here. So it's still an interacting problem. So that's sort of the basic dynamical mean field construction. What it does is it takes a problem, a quantum problem on the lattice, which has hoppings and U, and what it associates with it is a single side problem where the electron has some retarded field which describes the ability of this electron to move in and out of that site, and that effective medium has to be determined in a self-consistent way. Now, this approach can be improved or expanded, for example, to take into account non-local interactions, for example, Vij and Inj. And one can also modify this effective action by introducing here more retarded interactions, such as n of tau prime, d0 of tau prime. This is one extension where this will also satisfy some self-consistency condition. Furthermore, this site need not be a physical site. It can be a cluster of sites. So this formalism, in many ways, is something that can be expanded in many different directions. And it gives the solution of the model in an important limit, which was introduced by Metzner and Folhart, where the Tijs are scaled like T divided by the square root of the dimensionality, while the U is kept of order 1. And it's easy to see why this is a limit as D goes to infinity. And it's very easy to see why this is the right limit to look for understanding the strong correlation problem, because the idea is to keep the kinetic energy of the same order as the interaction so they can fight on a fair basis. And the kinetic energy is Tij times CiCj. This is of order 1 over square root of d. This is of order 1 over square root of d. But here we sum over d neighbors, which gives us a factor of d. While the interaction is completely local, so this states of order 1. So by scaling things this way, we can preserve some fair competition between the important elements of the problem. Okay, and then this has also the character of a mean field, but now it's a dynamical mean field because this is a function of frequency, which allows us to store all the different energy scales that we have in the strong correlation problem. Okay, so now let me sort of summarize what came out of this. So there are several results that are sort of relevant. This is sort of the Haber model is like a toy model. It's the simplest model in which we can start approaching the question, what does the electron do when it's neither band-like nor atom-like. For example, we can ask, can we get a phase diagram for the Hubbard model, such as the phase diagram of the V2O3 system? And the answer is yes. So provided that we have enough frustration to get to, so that an L temperature and the ordering is sufficiently low. So there is, and that's a question that was controversial for a few years, there is a Mach transition if you have frustration. We learned in this workshop already that Masa Imada finally was able to show that this conclusion is not just a mean field result, but also occurs in two-dimensional systems, provided, again, provided you have enough frustration. So somehow there's, for the first time, there's some continuity between the mean dynamic and mean field ideas, which are valid at high dimensions in principle, and real life in 2D. So I think this is sort of a correct statement, not just about the mean field theory, something that was debated for many years, but also about the situation in 3D systems. Second, what happens as the electron has to go from this side to this side? And again, the mode transition takes place via transfer of spectral weight. So for example, one question that we can ask is, how does the spectral function of the electron evolve as we go through here? And if we start at very high temperatures, we're insulating, and the spectral function has very little weight at low, so this will be high T, would have very little weight at low frequencies, and then it begins to develop some weight as we lower the temperature. So this is how the system evolves from high T to low T along this line. And I just mentioned this, but again, this transfer of spectral weight as sort of the mechanism for understanding how that operates occurs through the through many parameters. Can be pressure, can be doping. The way that the system reconciles this internal contradiction of having to be band-like and atomic-like is by being both, by having these atomic features here, which are like the Hubbard bands, and these low-energy features that they are more k-space-like. And the resistivity can be very large, but that sort of depends on details, whether it's linear, where it's quadratic, whether it saturates. But in principle, the electron in this crossover region between band and atom is not well defined in k-space. It has a very large relaxation rate for momentum, has large self-energy. Okay, so this is sort of in a nutshell some results of the MFT. And now, if I have like 10 minutes, I would like to wrap it up and say how we go from here to real materials.
I have a question. In general, this Hamiltonian up and down, right, it contains operators at different times on the path.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an arbitrary function of the whole path. Now you're expanding in two-point correlations. What's the expansion parameter?
Again, I mean, the expansion, I told you what it was. I mean,
so higher order correlations are...
You can show rigorously that they're down by powers of 1 over d, but you may want to decide to include them on physical grounds. You know that when you have fermion theories, the two-point coupling is always relevant. The four-point coupling tends to be marginal in a Fermi liquid, and higher order correlation functions are certainly irrelevant because fermions cannot be at the same point. So it's also, from that point of view, it's a sensible expansion, but the justification is that.
If there's no, you're assuming there's no upper critical dimension for this?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
Is there a systematic expansion?
Well, the way we're going about expanding this is not via systematic expansions, because we believe that for certain things, this limit is quite singular. That is, that's an excellent question. You can ask what's left out of this. So what's left out of this is a scale, which is the exchange, which is Tij squared over U, which is now of order 1 over square root of B, which we're sending to infinity. And this is okay. This scaling works nicely if you have an order phase, because if you have a net magnetization, then this thing still stays of order 1, and we can treat very nicely all the magnetic phases. But if you're in a fluctuating paramagnetic phase, then you still have locally this scale, but since you don't have order, you lose it. So the important thing is to recover that. And the way we do that is not by trying to do an expansion in this, which would be horribly singular, but formulating the same kind of dynamical mean field theory, but now for a little cluster where you can have your electrons forming the pairs. Okay? So that's the reason why, in some sense, this idea of infinite dimensions and expanding around it was not a useful way to go beyond this problem, and one is taking now different avenues.
And the other question was, when you deal with this Hamiltonian system, it's all done numerically.
Okay, well, okay, so I swept under the rug a lot of things. I mean, it's a combination. How do we deal with that? I mean, there are various approaches. There are fully numerical approaches. There are partially numerical and partially analytical approaches. I mean, and there are a lot of things that can be shown completely analytically. There was a big controversy over whether there really was a mode transition when the system is fully frustrated. That is, do you really have a region where you have two solutions, when you have a UC1, a UC2, and you have really a mode point? All this can be shown completely analytically and demonstrated, and that's, I think, how this controversy was resolved. So the beauty of this is that you have, it's complicated enough that has the physics that you search, but it's still simple enough that you can do numerically. Furthermore, you have lots of different analytic ways to looking at limiting cases and constructing a picture of the problem. So it stands in between the fully numerical approach to the 2D and the 3D problem and something which is fully analytic, like you can do in one dimension. Okay.
So once this framework being set up, I mean, pretty cheap approaches to solving this local problem would produce this 3D structure of low to density of states.
For example. Right. All the insights can be gotten. Most of the things depend, in fact, on the analytic properties and the character of this impurity model, coupled to this self-consistency condition, than from the exact solution of the impurity model, which is the hard part. Okay, so now what I want to say is, how do we go from here to real materials? And I just wanted to give you some examples to illustrate the flavor of the things that we want to do. So now let's just search in the periodic table for situations where we have strong correlations, but they're still simple enough. And strong correlations, that means systems that are somehow in between band-like and atomic-like. And there are many examples, and this is an active area of research. I will just give some examples here from my own interest or expertise. Something having to do with 5F electrons. If we move on the periodic table, we start with thorium. We have protactinium, uranium, neptunium, plutonium, americium, and so on. As we go this way, the F potential gets deeper, and the F electron gets more and more localized. So it turns out that up to here, the electron is itinerant. This is simple elements. Here, the electron is localized. And there's something like a mode transition, a delocalization transition happening a little bit in between neptunium and plutonium. And in fact, plutonium is one element which is actually very difficult to treat.
It's probably not obvious to everybody what it means to be in between.
Oh, okay. People do alloys. People have studied this problem in great detail, so they construct alloys. So they do neptunium 1 minus X, plutonium X, for example. So, and in fact, so here one can think of a localization, delocalization transition as taking place as we move around the periodic table. And we've been able, for example, to look at physical properties of this material and try to understand some puzzling aspects of the electronic structure here. Just as a reference, density functional theory, which is a very accurate theory for plutonium, it fails. And if you do the best GGA calculations, still the volume is off between 30 and 35%. And again, I think the physical reason is the fact that here the electron is neither localized nor delocalized. And therefore, if you treat it, the density functional implementation thinks it's fully itinerant and then overbinds the system. Okay. Then if you take the electron as core and don't let it participate in the bonding, then the volume comes out to be 30% too big. So an approach such as this, where we combine it with realistic band structure, is able to come close to the correct volume. And again, the approach is, again, based on effective actions. One defines an effective action not just for the density, but also for the Green's function of the F electron. And one can construct an effective action for two quantities, and it's an exact construction. Then we need approximations. The approximations are based on the dynamical mean field ideas to get an approximate form for this functional. But what I want to stress is that it not only gives total energy, but it also gives us, together with the total energy, the spectra. So now there's a cross-check. You don't only get a number, which is the total energy or the density that you cannot measure, but you also get the local spectra, which is what you measure in photoemission. And there, for plutonium, it reproduces the correct features of the experiment. The bands, if you do a non-interacting calculation, have a minimum at the Fermi level. That's because you have two bands which are spin orbit split in plutonium. The dynamical mean field theory gives you actually a maximum because you have something like a quasi-particle peak which is forming, and the experiment is close to a maximum than to a minimum. So that's one sort of briefly, one story of how one uses this to describe materials. And the other example is something that Sascha Lichtenstein did in connection with iron and nickel. And again, when you think of iron and nickel, you don't think of these as materials which are near a Mott transition or in any way. But, and in fact, at zero temperature, these are the classic examples of systems which are perfectly well described by the density functional theory. But if you look at how these systems behave at high temperatures, then the chi minus 1 in these materials have a very large Curie law. So chi, as a function of temperature, has some mu square effective divided by T minus TC. And this effective moment is actually bigger than the order moment at low temperatures. So at high temperatures, you can think of iron and nickel as having atoms. You have a large moment, which gives you this large Curie law. While at very low temperatures, this really forms bands with a small order moment. So again, to describe this in a whole region of temperature is a challenge and requires a theory which is not perturbative in either the weak coupling or the strong coupling end to really cover the whole regime. And again, the agreement with the experiment is not perfect, but just let me give you some idea where things are. Then for iron, and nickel, the things that one would like to predict is what is the moment at high temperatures and what is the TC. And basically this would be iron and nickel, and this would be the TC of the theory and the TC of the experiment. And for iron is 1900, and for the theoretical value.
Bobby, yes. Something 1,020 for iron.
Hmm?
Isn't that around 1,020, 1,030?
1,000?
The
experiment.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yes, the experiment is 1,040. And for nickel, the theory is around 700, and the experiment is 631. And then the other quantities that one can try to study is the effective moment at high temperatures from theory and from experiment. And the theory is around 3.1, and the experiment is also 3.12, and the theory is 1.5, and the experiment is 1.62. So there are two things to stress. As far as the TC for iron, there's a fairly big discrepancy, but as far as the order moments and the high temperature moments, this stuff is more or less okay. And one can also rationalize why the TC for iron is overestimated by the theory, because it's a single site theory which is only taking into account, it takes into account all the quantum fluctuations from zero to beta, but it is still a single site theory. So it's natural to expect, by analogy to ordinary spin systems, that once one goes to bigger systems, bigger clusters, the TC should go down. And one can also rationalize why the agreement is better for nickel than for iron, because nickel is a much stiffer system than iron. The spin wave stiffness is at least a factor of 2 bigger. So spatial fluctuations should be, in fact, more important for iron than for nickel.
Gabby.
Yes.
One might mention that there's a density functional based statistical mechanical theory of the Curie temperature.
Yes.
For these materials. The Jorfian co-workers, which does well for iron and for cobalt, but not for nickel. Mm-hmm. And it's a different sort of theory.
I would like to say something, a comment on that. I mean, over many years, there have been attempts to try to grasp this problem. And Geoffrey and co-workers have developed something which is called the local moment approach disorder local moment approach. And it's a little bit like a phenomenological approach. I think that can be viewed now, in some sense, as a limiting case of the dynamic and mean field theory. The point is, if you want to describe theoretically a local moment, what you need is an action which is not Gaussian. You need to have a U in the problem to really make the moment. And in that sense, I think that ultimately what the dynamic and mean field theory will do is will justify, and eventually when one does more sites, converge to experimentally measured results and justify some phenomenological approaches such as the ones that Geoffrey et al. Took. I mean, it's clear that both iron and nickel cannot be described by band theory. You need to do something to form the moment. This is just the technically correct way, I believe, of carrying out this kind of calculation. But anyway, I mean, just to finish here, where do we go from here? I didn't stress this is probably enough, but what do we want to know philosophically about materials? We want several things. we want some qualitative pictures of what the states are, have some intuitive picture why iron and nickel, which are so similar, why do they do different things? And this method, I think, besides giving numbers, also gives a lot of insights. One can, for example, look at the spin-spin correlation function and see that iron is really a lot more localized, while nickel is more itinerant. The spin-spin correlation functions fall off much faster for nickel than for iron. One can understand why nickel is more correlated than iron, why there are satellites in the spectra of nickel while not in the spectra of iron. I mean, one can really get insights into sort of why plutonium plays such a special role in the periodic table, why different phases of plutonium differ from each other. But also, I think that with enough effort, this can be turned into a more quantitative tool. Now, what are the limitations? And where are the directions that one needs to go? As I said, a lot has been gained from studying a single site, but there are singular perturbations, such as the exchange, which requires to consider basically larger systems. And that is still in its infancy and really requires significant extensions. And there are various directions in which the dynamic and mean field as formulated here can go. One is by increasing basically the cluster size. Another direction is by treating better the weakly interacting electrons, switching from LDA, for example, to GW. And third, and perhaps a direction which is really very important, is to take into account longer range interactions, so beyond the local interactions. And what we want is we want to study materials and get simple properties and at the same time develop the methods. So that's basically more or less in a nutshell what we're planning to do. Okay? Thanks.